Welcome to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds, a weekly podcast for pharmacists, physicians, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners who are interested in learning more about clinical pharmacology topics. I'm your host, Sarah Thompson, Director of Pharmacy Education and Academic Affairs at Mayo Clinic. To claim pharmacology CE credit or to get a copy of presentation slides, visit ce.mayo.edu/pharmacypodcast. In the 2023 COPD Gold Guidelines, there is a stronger recommendation for the utilization of blood eosinophil counts in guiding the use of inhaled corticosteroids. Historically, use of blood eosinophils has been less clearly defined. Let's delve into the literature with pharmacist Katie Bai to elucidate the predictive value of blood eosinophils, its application to inhaled corticosteroid use in the treatment of COPD, as well as explore the role of alternative anti-inflammatory agents.
Chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD as we will refer to for the remainder of this presentation, is the third leading cause of death, according to the World Health Organization. Subsequently, according to the American Lung Association, approximately 1.3 million visits to the emergency department each year can be attributed to COPD and disease and exacerbations subsequently related to that. These breathtaking statistics truly emphasize the importance that us as clinicians need to take in the context of management of COPD and the prevention of future exacerbations. So join me today in breathing new life into COPD exacerbation prevention. My goals for this presentation are threefold. First and foremost, we will describe the pathophysiology and risk factors that are associated with COPD exacerbations. Secondly, I hope to summarize the strengths and limitations of eosinophilic biomarkers as predictive monitoring tools for COPD exacerbations. And lastly, I hope to discuss anti-inflammatory agent choices in COPD and how we can best tailorize these therapies based upon patient-specific factors. In support of our objectives for today, let me introduce you to a patient case. Meet TK, a 46-year-old male that presents to the emergency room with increased shortness of breath, dyspnea, increased sputum production, and all of this started 3 days ago. Provided below are our relevant past medical history that we are presently aware of, which include hypertension, COPD, chronic heart failure, and major depressive disorder. And we know that he is a current smoker. We will continue to follow this case throughout the periodically throughout the duration of our presentation. Before we delve further into the literature, I think it's important to first define what COPD is, its defining features, and then more narrowly focus on the targeted aspect of inflammation, which will be the point of interest and discussion for today. So globally, COPD is a heterogeneous disease that is classified by irreversible airway or lung airway obstruction, and it's predominantly defined by bronchitis or airway inflammation and emphysema or gas trapping within the lungs, which is secondary to alveoli damage, which decreases our surface area for gas exchange. As I mentioned, the interest and focus of our presentation today will be discussing more of our inflammatory pathway, which, in a broad overview, our inflammation can be attributed to the production of eosinophils, which then result in an increased recruitment and release of inflammatory cytokines, which then thus propitiate airway inflammation, remodeling, and lung damage. And all of this is in the context of exposure to noxious particles and pathogens. Unfortunately, as mentioned, COPD is an irreversible disease, which further warrants the importance of us as clinicians in being mindful of our current treatment goal, which is to prevent disease progression. And one of those things in which we need to prevent is patients' worsening of COPD secondary to exacerbations. Provided on the slide above are some of our most common attributed exacerbation risk factors, which for us as clinicians, it's important when patients present with worsening COPD, we are mindful of. Some of these characteristics include smoking, changes in environment, which can be both climate-driven and temperature, and also with air quality, Acute illness, which can be both bacterial and viral in nature, medication non-adherence, comorbidities, which include ill-managed chronic heart failure, lung cancer, and concomitant asthma, and previous exacerbations. Previous exacerbations is something that we've seen in the literature as one of our best predictors of future exacerbations. And with that in mind, I think it's extremely important for us to be mindful of what an exacerbation is and what are characterizable traits of a patient that presents with an exacerbation, what that looks like. And it can be attributed to three main things: increased sputum production, increased dyspnea, and increased coughing or wheezing. These are three of our most physiologic presentations of patients with COPD exacerbations. Something that the GOLD 2023 guidelines emphasized and redefined with this exacerbation is that the presentation of these worsening symptoms occurs within 14 days. And in light of our worsening symptoms, it's important that we're able to recognize our acute management from an exacerbation standpoint, which can be broken down into three main categories: mild, moderate, and severe. Something that I would really like to note with these exacerbations and our subsequent management are that each of the pharmacologic therapies, including oral corticosteroids, antibiotics, and even warranting elevated care, these are not all things that are required for patients that experience a, for instance, moderate exacerbation. But I think just for completeness sake, this is something that I want you to be mindful of. And also how we manage our acute exacerbations is also something that is relevant to our inclusion criteria for some of the trials that we will be discussing today. So keeping that in mind as we move forward throughout the duration of this presentation. As I discussed, the importance of managing and preventing exacerbations cannot be emphasized enough. I think this graphic does a really nice job of illustrating this importance. Provided on the graph above, this blue line ultimately illustrates a patient's lung function over time throughout the duration of the course of their journey with COPD. And ultimately what we can see, which is reflected with the arrows indicating exacerbations, is that when a patient experiences an exacerbation influencing lung function, despite the fact that we may provide patients with sufficient treatment and time to recover, generally seen throughout practice, patients never really fully return to their baseline, which further emphasizes the point that prevention of exacerbations from occurring in the first place is of utmost importance. And in recognition of the discussion that we just had on exacerbations, identifying exacerbation symptoms, and the importance of subsequently managing an exacerbation, this leads me to my first patient assessment question. Which you can text Poll Ev or use the Poll Everywhere app to participate in. As I'm giving you a little bit of time to get logged in, a helpful tip for the audience: if you are struggling to see the graphic on your phone, feel free to turn your phone horizontally to buy yourself a little bit more real estate when looking at this assessment question. TK is a 46-year-old male that we were introduced to at the beginning of this presentation. He presents to the emergency room with increased shortness of breath, dyspnea, and increased sputum production, which, as we discussed, are all characteristics of a COPD exacerbation. Provided below is relevant information. And what I hope to have you guys do with this assessment question is drop a pin on some of the potential exacerbation risk factors that we discussed at an earlier point in this presentation. And seeing that a majority of you have had an opportunity to weigh in, I would agree with the risk factors that were identified by us collectively as a group. So some of the risk factors that I picked out in this case were that the patient does have COPD, so inherently that would put them at risk for a COPD exacerbation. The patient also has chronic heart failure, so if we weren't sufficiently managing that disease state, that could also be a risk factor. And great, I'm seeing a lot for smoking, and smoking is one of our number one risk factors for COPD exacerbations. So excellent work, everyone. So now that we've discussed exacerbations and our importance in prevention of exacerbations. This is a slide that's supposed to emphasize the backbone of pharmacologic therapy that we use for COPD. Reflective on the graph presented on the right is a list of our pharmacologic agents that we currently use to manage COPD, which include LAMAs or long-acting muscarinic antagonists, our LABAs or SABAs, which are our long-acting beta agonists or short-acting beta agonists, our ICS or inhaled corticosteroids, oral steroids, and roflumilast. These are all medications that have been discussed within our current guidelines utilized, which are the GOLD guidelines, and provided and indicated by the PLUS are relative pharmacologic activity with respect to bronchoconstriction or inflammation. Speaking of the GOLD guidelines, something that I really want to discuss is a recent change in practice that is illustrated within the GOLD 2023 guidelines. Of note, to be upfront, I think this presentation is rather timely in the sense that the GOLD 2024 guidelines were recently released within the past couple of weeks. However, for this presentation, we will be exclusively focusing on the changes from the GOLD 2023 guideline. Historically, COPD has been assessed in four different categories: A, B, C, and D, which were categorized based off of symptoms, which were represented by our MMRC scores and CAT scores, and by based on our exacerbation frequency and severity. However, with our new GOLD 2023 guidelines, which emphasizes recognizing the clinical relevance of exacerbations irregardless of symptom presentation, we now see that our clinical assessment is boiled down into three categories, A, B, and E, for exacerbation. And provided below is a current way in which we strategically help treat patients that reside within these different categories. So a bronchodilator for patients that fall within category A, LABA-LAMA combo for patients that resolve in category B, and then LABA-LAMA and consideration of the use of inhaled corticosteroids with our patients that experience exacerbations. Another change that I really want to emphasize with the GOLD 2023 guidelines is the further discussion that is placed on the utilization of blood eosinophil counts to help us more precisely treat patients with COPD. Blood eosinophils, as previously discussed, are a non-surrogate or a surrogate marker for inflammation within the respiratory tract. There is no standardized way in which we collect blood eosinophils in current practice, but different ways include both sputum blood eosinophil counts and peripheral blood eosinophil counts. For the practicality, we will be narrowly focusing on peripheral blood eosinophil counts today, and the ways in which those are reported are also not standardized, both by looking at absolute eosinophil counts reflected by percentage and our total eosinophil counts, which is represented by cells per microliter squared. So as I discussed, eosinophils are a non-surrogate marker, presumably, for inflammation. So a question that was often asked and implemented within the GOLD 2023 guidelines is assessing this relationship between eosinophils and inhaled corticosteroids. And Pavard and colleagues asked the question of whether or not patients that had higher levels of baseline blood eosinophil counts and whether or not they ultimately had a greater reduction in their annual exacerbation rate due to the use of inhaled corticosteroids in those patients that presumably have increased inflammation within their respiratory tract. Pavard and colleagues looked at three different trials: the Tristan trial, the Inspire trial, and one done by Goldner and colleagues, and ultimately looked at trials that had parallel designs groups that are double-blinded, randomized with at least one non-inhaled corticosteroid comparator. All of the patients within these trials had baseline blood eosinophil counts prior to use of pharmacologic therapy. And ultimately, what we can see within these three trials that Pavard and colleagues looked at is that the patients that fell within these different subsets of the trials, they all had higher levels of blood eosinophil counts compared to the remainder of the population. And ultimately, what we looked at when we compared those patients and their use of inhaled corticosteroids, is especially in the INSPIRE and TRISTAN trial, are that patients that had higher levels of blood eosinophil counts that used inhaled corticosteroids, they had lower annual exacerbation rates compared to patients that had lower eosinophil counts. Of note, Goldner and colleagues' study was not powered or adequately powered to detect any clinically meaningful difference. And with that in mind, we weren't able to extrapolate any information that would be of relevance to our discussion for today. To further illustrate the point that I just made, I'm going to utilize these tree plots to help us identify and see this relationship between patients that have higher levels of blood eosinophil counts and the use of inhaled corticosteroids within this patient population. So to orient you to the screen, our patients that are reflected by the orange box are reflective of patients that have higher levels of blood eosinophil counts. Conversely, our blue circles represent patients that have lower baseline blood eosinophil counts. And ultimately, what we can see demonstrated by the stars with favoring inhaled corticosteroids is that patients that had these higher levels of blood eosinophil counts ultimately had lower annual exacerbation rates compared to their counterparts. To further support the point that was made by Pavard and colleagues, let me introduce you to three secondary analyses of three randomized control trials looking at a myriad of different treatment comparators and baseline blood eosinophil counts with the ultimate primary outcome looking at annual exacerbation rates. The Trinity trial, the Impact trial, and the Tribute trial all had patients with both high and low baseline blood eosinophil counts. Provided on the screen below is relevant inclusionary criteria that fell within each of these trials. I would like to draw your attention to the Impact trial, which when you look at the inclusionary criteria of this particular trial, it encompasses a wider subset of patients, given the fact that there were two different ways in which patients would qualify to be included in the trial based off of their FEV1 score and number of moderate to severe exacerbations, meaning this population ultimately had a larger trial group. And ultimately, in looking at all of these different groups with their various comparators, looking at both fixed and open dose delivery of inhaled corticosteroids and other pharmacologic agents, what we can see is that patients, regardless of total or absolute blood eosinophil counts, patients that had higher levels reflected by the red boxes on the screen of blood eosinophil counts ultimately had lower annual exacerbation rates when inhaled corticosteroids were used compared to their counterparts. So, in reflection on the data that we just had, I'm guessing you're probably wondering and asking yourself, if these patients have higher levels of blood eosinophil counts and are ultimately having lower annual rates of exacerbations, why isn't everybody on an inhaled corticosteroid? And I would say that that was a question that I also had. And I think that that's a study, or Roche and colleagues really helps us add to that question or answer that question that many of us may have. Ultimately, the question comes into play as to whether or not there's a relationship between eosinophils and their predictive value of exacerbations, and whether or not there's any clinical relevance with that in mind. Roche and colleagues ultimately examined this relationship by comparing data of looking at eosinophils compared to maintenance therapy from the FLAME trial. Provided below are our relevant inclusion and exclusionary criteria. And in this pre-specified analysis of the FLAME trial, looking at three different patient subset groups categorized by patients that had blood eosinophil counts of less than 150 cells per microliter, patients that fell within an intermediate category of 150 to 300 cells, and patients that had blood eosinophil counts of greater than 300 cells. What we ultimately found is that the rate of moderate to severe exacerbations did not increase with these increasing baseline blood eosinophil counts when we looked at all of the data from the 52 weeks trials that, or from the 52 week trial that we did have. In further support of the findings of Roche and colleagues, Singh and colleagues had a larger population group, including nearly 22,000 patients, and included 11 randomized control trials, and ultimately also assessed that relationship between eosinophil counts and their predictive value of exacerbation rates. One added value of this trial is that Roche and colleagues further stratified their information based off of the number of exacerbation rates that these patient populations had, in addition to whether or not they had baseline use of inhaled corticosteroids. And ultimately, what they found is that blood eosinophil counts were not reliable in the prediction of future exacerbations. Something that I think is valuable about this particular piece of literature is that it included 11 randomized control trials, all that had seemingly similar trial designs. However, I think the limitation of this is that there could have been other disease states that we weren't able to control for within these patient population groups. And I think that that's something that we have to just be mindful of when we're looking at these larger meta-analyses, is that, and then our ability to replicate these findings in the outside world as well. Ultimately, in summation of our relationship and understanding of eosinophils, what we can take away is based upon the literature is that there is in fact a relationship between inhaled corticosteroids and our blood eosinophil count, in the sense that patients that have higher baseline blood eosinophil counts generally have a positive predictive response to inhaled corticosteroids compared to patients that have lower blood eosinophil counts. However, blood eosinophil counts are not predictive of future exacerbations. And I think that recognizing that these two points are not interchangeable is extremely important to keep in context when we're looking at clinical practice. And in notion of that, this brings me to my next patient case question. So TK has been thankfully stabilized from his acute exacerbation, and we have placed him on a LABA-LAMA combo. The team is currently looking for additional agents to optimize his patient care based upon his risk factors for additional exacerbations, and they obtained a blood eosinophil count, which was found to be 100 cells per microliter. And based upon this information and what we have discussed in our literature currently, I'm curious as to which of the following statements is true related to eosinophils that may help TK's team in clinically navigating the discussion of whether or not we can use particular pharmacologic agents. And seeing that a number of us have been able to weigh in, I would agree with the majority that ultimately blood eosinophils can be used as a predictor for our use of inhaled corticosteroids. A would be incorrect in the sense that blood eosinophil counts can be a helpful clinical tool in being able to help us identify the predictive value of our use of inhaled corticosteroids based upon a patient's blood eosinophil count. C would be incorrect because, as we had discussed with the findings of Roche and colleagues, that ultimately we do not have sufficient evidence to say that blood eosinophils can be used to help calculate likelihood of future exacerbations. I think to further discuss this point, blood eosinophils are a helpful tool, but their use alone to help quantify this risk is not something that we can confidently use in practice. You have to look at the clinical picture of the patient, including their future or their past exacerbation rate, in addition to other modifiable risk factors that we had discussed earlier on in the presentation. And I think that that also lends well to answer D, that again, blood eosinophil counts are not predictive in our ability to look at future exacerbation risk. And to further illustrate the clinical decision that's made when a patient presents with COPD, and ultimately we classify these patients based upon their exacerbation risk or their symptom severity, I wanted to illustrate what this decision looks like and how we can integrate the use of blood eosinophils in our clinical practice. So as you can see in the graphic presented on the screen above, generally speaking, when a patient presents and is diagnosed with COPD, we begin with their initial clinical assessment, looking at both their symptomatic presentation as well as their exacerbation risk previously. And once we're able to categorize these patients, as you can see, either by GOLD A and B or E, really the point of consideration in which we would start integrating the use of blood eosinophil counts is with these patients that would be presenting in our GOLD E category, as well as patients that present with recurrent exacerbations, as this is the point in therapy at which we would start to look at optimizing and escalating our pharmacologic agents for patients. And as we move further down the diagram, looking at our blood eosinophil assessment, we're presented with a choice in consideration of inhaled corticosteroid use. And those two thresholds are blood eosinophil counts of less than 100 cells per microliter and blood eosinophil counts of greater than 300 cells per liter. In the interest of staying within the confines of this presentation, what I will tell you about blood eosinophil counts of less than 100 cells per microliter is that patients that utilize inhaled corticosteroids with blood eosinophil counts within this threshold, they're at a higher predisposition for the development of infections, including pneumonia and mycobacteria infections due to the presence of proteobacteria within their respiratory tract. Conversely, patients that have blood eosinophil counts of greater than 300 cells per microliter, within the literature, this is a point in which we can demonstrate that there has been a greater level of success for patients with the utilization of inhaled corticosteroids. However, I think something that's important to touch upon is that these numbers are numbers and it's not absolute. So when we're looking at the use of inhaled corticosteroids, it's being able to balance the benefits and risks in use of those and using blood eosinophils as a tool to help us weigh in on that decision. And as I alluded to, inhaled corticosteroids and their use in COPD prevention of exacerbation is not a decision that should be taken lightly. I think ultimately it's a very individualized decision based upon a lot of different patient factors, but in weighing both the benefits and risks, which are displayed on the screen above, I think it's important to recognize that there may be factors that make a clinical decision team weigh towards maybe utilizing an inhaled corticosteroid or not utilizing it. And some of those points would be potential increased risk for infection, secondary to medications that they may be using that suppress their immune systems, otherwise baseline immunosuppression, secondary to diseases that they may concomitantly have. This graphic does a nice job at illustrating some of the tools and factors for consideration of the use of inhaled corticosteroids based upon the risks and benefits that we just previously touched upon. Looking at some of the factors, such as frequent events of pneumonia or blood eosinophil counts of less than 100, or even a history of mycobacterial infections, these would be instances in which we would maybe lean against the utilization of inhaled corticosteroids as an add-on therapy for the prevention and optimization of pharmacotherapy. Whereas when we're looking more in the moderate area for deciding, looking at both patients' exacerbations, as well as where their middle ground blood eosinophil count resides, these would be points in which we would be also looking at other exacerbation risk factors and really allowing ourselves to weigh in as to whether or not we need to utilize an inhaled corticosteroid within this patient population. But ultimately, as I touched upon in the previous slide, this is a decision that's not black and white. It's very gray in nature. And I think we have to really be able to weigh out our treatment care goals with the patient when we're looking at the use of inhaled corticosteroids. And as we discussed, and building off of the diagram that we previously utilized in looking at classifying our patients that have COPD and further stratifying their risk and maybe potential use of inhaled corticosteroids based upon their blood eosinophil counts and the predictive value of those in the use of inhaled corticosteroids to help us with the prevention of annual exacerbations, the question then becomes, if you use inhaled corticosteroids, or you have a patient that maybe isn't a great candidate for it, and we've optimized our therapies, but patients are still poorly managed or presenting with exacerbations, what is next? And when we look at that, there's a couple different options for things that are currently being investigated and studied or currently are evaluated in the literature, which we will next take a deep dive into to help us with the prevention of future exacerbations. So let me introduce you to our first agent of today, roflumilast, which is something that we had initially talked upon on our first pharmacotherapy stage or slide. So roflumilast is a phosphodiesterase 4 inhibitor, which decreases the production of cyclic AMP and thus decreases inflammation within the respiratory tract. Roflumilast has been studied as an add-on therapy for the use of prevention of COPD exacerbations, and Martinez and colleagues with the REACT trial investigated this benefit as to whether or not the utilization of roflumilast comparatively to placebo had any clinically meaningful difference in patient outcomes, looking specifically at moderate to severe exacerbations. Provided below are our relevant exclusionary criteria, and something that I really want to highlight of this trial and its inclusion criteria are that patients within this trial, they ultimately had symptoms of chronic bronchitis, and they also had greater than 2 exacerbations within the past year. Also of note, the patients were utilizing inhaled corticosteroids and a LABA therapy for the last 12 months prior to inclusion within this trial. At the time of this trial, we had not yet had further data for the utilization of our LAMA agents, and therefore at this time, this was our current standard of care for patients that had exacerbations or higher categorization of COPD. And ultimately what we found when we compared the use of roflumilast to placebo within these trial patient population groups is that the use of roflumilast ultimately had 13.2% lower annual exacerbation rates in comparison to placebo. Some of the relevant safety and side effect profiles of this medication when compared to placebo, most notably being diarrhea, weight loss, which was about 2.2 kilograms within the roflumilast patient population, nausea, and then I included death as well. And the reason why I included death within our safety outcomes is to emphasize the point that while this is a helpful medication in decreasing our annual exacerbation rates, it's not a life-saving medication. And I think that's important to set our expectations for what these add-on therapies can do for the use in COPD, is decreasing our risk of exacerbations, but not decreasing our risk of mortality in comparison to placebo. So currently we've discussed the one and only add-on therapy specifically focusing on inflammation and targeting inflammation, which is increased in patients that present with acute exacerbations and have increasing exacerbations, is that inflammatory component. Next, I'd like to introduce you to some of the more newly recognizable monoclonal antibody agents, which target specifically type 2 inflammation, which in the literature, approximately 20 to 40% of patients with COPD have this particular type of inflammation, endotype of COPD, which is reflective of increased levels of eosinophils within your respiratory tract. So these specifically targeted interleukin agents are mepolizumab, benralizumab, and dupilumab. And ultimately, their proposed mechanism of action is the decreased production of eosinophils within the respiratory tract, thus decreasing inflammation is the proposed hypothesis behind their use. Looking at our first agent that was studied, mepolizumab, Pavin and colleagues utilized two different trials, the Metarex and Metaro trials, which included both patients of eosinophilic type and non-eosinophilic type COPD, and looked at a myriad of different dosing schema, including both 100 milligrams subcutaneous every 4 weeks and 300 milligrams subcutaneous every 4 weeks for 52 years. And in looking at annual rates of moderate to severe exacerbations, what we can see is that in a pre-specified meta-analysis of the Metaro and Metarex trials, looking at that 100 standardized 100 milligram subcutaneous every 4 weeks dosing schema that was touched upon in both trials, and specifically breaking down our patients within these categories of with respect to their blood eosinophils, what we can find is that patients that utilized mepolizumab at 400 or at 100 milligrams, they were associated at a lower annual exacerbation rate for patients that had an eosinophilic phenotype. So eosinophil counts of greater than 300. Building upon the findings of the mepolizumab trials, benralizumab was the next monoclonal antibody that was studied with a similar mechanism of action comparatively to our mepolizumab group. And the Terranova and the Galathea trials also aimed to look at whether or not add-on therapy of these specific targeted agents helped with decreasing overall annual exacerbation rates. Provided below are our relevant inclusionary criteria, and when looking at our primary outcome of annual exacerbation rates in patients with a higher blood eosinophil count, specifically 220 cells per microliter, what we can find within this trial design is that ultimately there was no significant difference in exacerbation rates between the benralizumab and placebo groups. Given the mixed evidence of both of the targeted therapies that we currently have, this leads me to the last trial, which is dupilumab, which was studied earlier this fall for the specifics of COPD. So ultimately, Bott and colleagues, they built off of the findings of the current trials of the mepolizumab and the mepolizumab and the benralizumab trials, and ultimately included patients with even higher blood eosinophil counts, respectively to the other two trials, with a baseline blood eosinophil count of greater than 300. Patients within this specific trial also had to be on triple therapy, so a LAMA-LABA combo with ICS, for at least 3 months, and had a dyspnea score of 2 or greater and a history of at least 2 moderate or 1 severe exacerbation within the past year. And when looking at dupilumab compared to placebo in patients that had this triple therapy, what we found is that patients that had received dupilumab and had this higher level of blood eosinophil counts, they ultimately had fewer annual exacerbations compared to placebo. And when in comparing the safety and side effect profile of both dupilumab to placebo, we can look at the fact that they're fairly matched from a side effect standpoint, with most notably looking at the fact that the dupilumab group had a higher incidence of headache development compared to placebo. However, when we're looking at our mortality outcomes in comparison between both the dupilumab and placebo groups, what we can find is that they are relatively matched. Again, touching upon the fact that this is an additive therapy and something that we currently do not have much information as far as the mortality component of this disease state itself. And when looking at our agents that we currently have to specifically target inflammation in patients that are at higher risk of exacerbations, what we can take away is that roflumilast is a relatively low-risk add-on therapy, and it is something that can be utilized in patients that have persistent bronchitis, which is something that is supported by the inclusion criteria of the REACT trial in which we reviewed. As for our interleukin-targeted therapies, dupilumab, mepolizumab, and benralizumab, currently I think that more information needs to be further vetted out before we can definitively take a stance on their place in practice. However, where I foresee their place in therapy is in the utilization of patients that have COPD and other concomitant eosinophilic type inflammatory disorders. So namely asthma, atopic dermatitis, and nasal polyps, given the fact that they have a higher inflammation predisposition as well. And these targeted therapies are already FDA approved for those indications. So in discussion of our alternative pharmacologic agents, this brings me to my last assessment question for today. So TK's team has just found out through chart review that the patient has a relevant past history of pneumonia, warranting 2 hospitalizations in the past year and a half. The team is still wanting to initiate an additional agent to optimize care. Presently, there is a blood eosinophil count that was obtained from our last assessment question of 100 cells per microliter. And currently, based upon that information described, which agent would be the most appropriate to suggest for add-on therapy? And seeing that a number of us have been able to weigh in, and in the interest of time, I will say that I agree with the majority of us that the add-on roflumilast would be the agent that I would have been inclined to recommend and initiate within this patient population, given the fact that the patient had a risk for pneumonia and they had had recent bouts of it. Thus, it would lower my threshold and inclination for wanting to start inhaled corticosteroids due to that risk of infections, thus decreasing or making answers A and C incorrect. And then dupilumab, as I said, further studies and information needs to be further vetted out before we can really take a definitive stance on their current use in clinical practice. So the answer would be B, roflumilast. And in conclusion, the main takeaway points that I'd like to leave you with today in our discussion of COPD and our hope and interest in preventing future exacerbations is that COPD is a multifaceted disease that's associated with a myriad of different risk factors. And being able to identify those when patients come in ill-managed really helps us with being better clinicians and being able to stratify the risk of our patients for future exacerbations, which would be taking into our next point of looking at blood eosinophils. And what we can find in our takeaways in that are that blood eosinophils have been proven to show utility in our predictive value of the use of inhaled corticosteroid response, but there isn't sufficient evidence with respect to our ability to predict future exacerbations. And finally, there are novel therapies that are being currently investigated for use. However, further research is warranted prior to their implementation in practice.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, subscribe using iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Thank you for listening to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds. Join us weekly for more exciting clinical pharmacology topics.